I insisted on checking on her myself. When I opened the door, the first thing I saw were the curtains blowing inside. I thought it was strange. I didn't remember leaving her window open. And that's when I saw him, that horrid little man holding my daughter. Heavy streams of tears flowed down the queen's face. Rapunzel rubbed her back, and Snow White held her hand tightly. "Breathe, Cinderella, breathe," Snow White told her. Cinderella caught her breath and continued. Then he looked me right in the eye and hopped out the window. I screamed and ran to the windowsill, trying to see if I could see them below, but they were gone, she said. That disgusting man disappeared with my baby. Snow White held her, and she cried into her shoulder. This is all my fault, said a soft voice across the room. Queen Sleeping Beauty stood at the window in the back of the ballroom, listlessly staring at the land outside. I'm the one she wants. I'm the one she's after, Sleeping Beauty said in a daze. Why doesn't she just take me? Why does she have to make everyone else suffer? This isn't your fault, Rapunzel said. You can't blame yourself for this, Snow White agreed. King Chance grew tired of pacing and groaned angrily. He needed someone to blame. Where are those useless fairies? He demanded. And why haven't they done something about this yet? A soft breeze blew through the ballroom, and twinkling lights of all the colors of the rainbow floated through the room. The fairy council slowly appeared out of thin air. Emeralda was first to appear. We're doing everything in our power, she said. She was tall, black, and beautiful. She wore a long emerald gown that matched her eyes and jewelry. Emeralda always had a soft but authoritative presence. She was someone you could trust, but never wanted to cross. Xanthus was next to arrive, and was followed by Skylene, the blue fairy. She had pale skin, hair the color of the sky, and robes the color of the ocean. Tangerina appeared shortly after her. She was the orange fairy, and actual bees flew around her beehive. Violetta, the purple fairy, and oldest of the council, popped up close to where Red and the twins were sitting. Rosette, the short, plump, and rosy-cheeked red fairy, appeared next. Coral, the youngest and the pink fairy, showed up shortly after that, hovering in the air thanks to her tiny wings. The fairy's colorful arrivals were a beautiful sight, but not beautiful enough to raise the spirits in the room.
Well, that's not enough, Chance yelled at them. The enchantress is one of you, isn't she? You outnumber her. Why can't you handle this?
We are greater than her in size, but not in strength, said Skylene, in her dreamlike voice.
She's managed to grow more powerful than we ever imagined, Xanthus said. I'm afraid even the fairy godmother is no match for her.
Speaking of the fairy godmother, has she or Mother Goose arrived yet? Emeralda asked, looking around the ballroom.
We need to begin.
Another soft breeze blew through the room, this time carrying white sparkling lights that circled into a vortex in the center of the room. A moment later, the twins' grandmother appeared with her crystal wand raised. The twins looked nervously at each other. Now that their grandmother was here, they were officially in the same room as everyone they wanted to avoid.
Forgive me for being late, the fairy godmother said, and politely acknowledged everyone in the room with a comforting nod. There was a bit of an issue in the other world.
The twins had never heard their world referred to as anything else but home before. It was odd to hear it have a name of its own, although not entirely surprising. What else had the fairies been calling it this entire time?
Red Riding Hood, my word, that is quite a dress you're wearing, the fairy godmother said when she saw Red sitting in the oversized gown.
Alex and Connor could hear each other's heartbeats and were terrified they were about to be discovered.
Well, Red said nervously, thinking as quickly as possible, it's important to dress your best when the world is at its worst, to raise morale.
Yes, I suppose that is true, the fairy godmother said, though she didn't sound fully convinced.
With all due respect, I don't believe this is the proper time to be talking about dresses in the other world, King Chance said, his frustration building every second spent without his daughter.
Will Mother Goose be joining us? Emeralda asked, getting the meeting back on track. The twins' grandmother dropped the subject of Red's dress.
No, she stayed behind in the other world, she said. My grandchildren are missing, so she agreed to continue searching for them while we have our discussion.
That's horrible, Red said, shaking her head a tad too much. I hope they're all right. I just love those two so much.
Alex and Connor shared a mutual eye roll.
Is everyone else here? The fairy godmother asked, still eyeing Red strangely.
Everyone but the elves, ma'am, Sir Lambton informed her from the side of the room. We sent word of our meeting to the Elf Empire, but they've chosen to miss it, feeling the current situation has nothing to do with them.
King Chandler sighed. Typical, he said. The elves never get involved unless they have to.
Thank you, Sir Lambton, the fairy godmother said. Then let's begin.
King Chant stormed up to her. Tell us why the enchantress can't be stopped. Why are all of you so incompetent? He shouted.
The fairy godmother looked at him with her trademark compassion.
Chance, I'm afraid I don't have your answers. Esmia is just as big a mystery to me as she is to all of you.
Then tell us what you know, Chance ordered. Where did this monster come from? What is she after now?
Sleeping Beauty took a few steps toward the fairy godmother.
I'm willing to give myself up to her if that's what she's after, she said. My dear, you were not responsible for any of this, the fairy godmother said. I'm afraid I'm the one who's entirely to blame. Esmia wouldn't be here if it weren't for me.
All the fairies lowered their heads, knowing the fairy godmother was telling the truth.
What do you mean, fairy godmother? Cinderella asked. Surely someone like you couldn't be accountable for a creature like that.
The fairy godmother closed her eyes and took a deep breath, deciding where to begin. There's so much to tell, and not enough time to tell it.
It all started centuries ago, on one of my first visits to the other world, the fairy godmother explained. It was a horrible time for that world. There was plague and war everywhere you looked. Today they refer to that period as the Dark Ages, and there couldn't be a better description. Sometimes the air would be filled with so much smoke from all the destruction, the sun would be hidden for days at a time. I discovered a little girl, all alone in the middle of the forest, no more than 5 years old. She was crying and was covered in ash and dirt. She told me that her name was Esmia, and that she lived in a village nearby. Like many of the villages at the time, hers had been invaded by a group of barbaric soldiers. They swept through the village and killed everyone in their path, including her family. The soldiers discovered Esmia hiding in a barn. However, when they tried harming her, the girl was able to defend herself using magic. She told me she had started a giant fire with just her hands, and that it consumed her entire village and all the soldiers with it. The girl took me to her village so I could see the damage for myself, and it was devastating. Not only had the villagers perished, but all the land around the town for acres was destroyed. I knew then that this girl was no ordinary child. Magic has always been a mysterious thing, but I'm absolutely astonished that a child in the middle of another dimension could have such capabilities. But for whatever reason, magic had found this girl and had saved her life, and I believe my discovering her was no accident. I didn't think she would survive the other world on her own, so I brought her back to our world. I knew she was special, because when we arrived in the fairy kingdom, the unicorns bowed, the fairy godmother said. Connor looked at his sister. The unicorns had bowed to them when they first traveled to the fairy kingdom. What did it mean? Esmia was raised there, the fairy godmother continued. We taught her how to use her magic, and she became a fairy. Her powers grew with time, and she proved herself to be one of the most gifted fairies the fairy kingdom had ever seen. Esmia was also the kindest, most honest, loving young woman I had ever known. She was so thankful I had brought her to live in our world, and received so much joy from helping others. I loved her like a daughter, and she became my apprentice. I was certain when my time came to an end, I could leave this world safely in her hands. I was positive she would be the next fairy godmother. We created the Happily Ever After Assembly in hopes that Esmia would lead it someday. But as Esmia grew into adulthood, she changed. Things were going on beyond our knowledge, things we couldn't see, and she became another person altogether. She became aggressive and mean-spirited. Her interest in fairy life faded completely. Helping people became a chore for her, and she started abusing her magic. It was during our first official meeting as the Happily Ever After Assembly that I knew Esmia was no longer the little girl I saved in the other world. We hadn't officially appointed a leader of the assembly yet, so I was presiding. The trolls and goblins had just been sanctioned to their own territory, but they were still enslaving innocent people from other kingdoms. I asked the rest of the assembly what the best solution was. Esmia blurted out, "Why don't we just drown them all? Thumbelina Stream practically runs through their territory. Just break a dam and be done with them. We can make it look like an accident." She almost seemed amused by the idea. Naturally, after an outburst like that, we couldn't appoint her to the head of the assembly as planned. We appointed Emerelda and the Fairy Council instead. When Esmia found out she had been replaced, she was enraged. She went on a tirade, dissociating herself from the assembly and the Fairy Kingdom altogether. She changed her entire appearance and refused to be known as a fairy, deeming herself an enchantress instead.
The next time we crossed paths with Esmia was at Sleeping Beauty's christening. She was uninvited, but we knew she would come anyway. We discovered Rumpelstiltskin had been working for her when he tried kidnapping Sleeping Beauty, and we confronted her about it. Esmia lost control and went on a rampage, cursing the princess to die after pricking her finger on the spindle of a spinning wheel. However, I knew that the curse wasn't only going to affect Sleeping Beauty. Esmia's powers were too strong for that amount of rage to be aimed at just an innocent child. Luckily, I was able to convert the curse into a harmless sleeping spell, and when she pricked her finger on a spinning wheel as planned, the entire kingdom was affected, confirming my suspicions. Esmia disappeared after the christening, and we never saw her again. We searched everywhere but found no trace of her. Later, word reached us that she had been poisoned by the same toxins that left the Upper Eastern Kingdom bare. We figured she must have died and stopped our search. Unfortunately, we were wrong. A year ago, my grandchildren accidentally found a way into this world and went missing. While I was searching for them, I made a troubling discovery. Small weeds started to grow in the northeast where the flowers and grass had grown. The land had revived itself from the poison, except the poison had obliterated everything good that had come from the soil, and the weeds had taken its place. I knew then it would only be a matter of time before Esmia resurfaced. I alerted the Fairy Council at once, and we spent the last year actively searching for her, but found nothing to lead us in the right direction. It wasn't until her recent attack on the Eastern Kingdom that we were positive she had returned. The crowd in the ballroom was even tenser after hearing Esmia's story.
"And why can't we stop her now?" King Chance demanded. "If her spells could be converted back then, why can't we get a grip on them anymore?"
"That's what I'm trying to tell you," the fairy godmother said. "We taught her everything she knows. We taught her how to use her magic from her heart. We had trained her to channel it from a good source. That's why every spell she ever cast could be altered. But when she was poisoned, anything good that was left in her soul was killed. Now Esmia's powers come from a place of darkness and anger, forces that we fairies don't stand a chance against. And believe me, Esmia has a lot of anger to feed off of."
Alex and Connor couldn't believe what she was saying. Was their grandmother insinuating that the Enchantress was unstoppable?
"So what are we to do?" Snow White asked.
The fairy godmother lowered her eyes and looked down at the floor, hating to say it as much as they hated hearing it.
"I don't know," she said softly.
And with that, whatever hope had survived was obliterated. It was as if the fairy godmother had told them the world was over. Suddenly, all the windows burst open and a monstrous wind blew inside the ballroom, knocking Sleeping Beauty to the ground. A gigantic bolt of lightning hit the floor so hard the entire palace buckled, and in its blinding flash, the Enchantress appeared. She was the most majestic person the twins had ever seen. Her hair and cape flowed through the ballroom, and although her mouth was still, her eyes smiled evilly through her long lashes.
"Hope I'm not late," Esmia said. "I do love a good story, especially when it's mine."
Alex and Connor clutched onto each other under Red's dress. Everyone in the room was frozen in fear.
"Don't tell me you're having another party without inviting me," Esmia said, glaring at all the royals and fairies around her. "You think you'd have learned your lesson from the last time you didn't include me?"
A smirk appeared on her face. Cinderella was the only person to move. She jumped out of her throne and ran straight toward the Enchantress with fists raised. King Chandler and Froggy were quick to grab hold of her, but she lunged with such determination, Rapunzel's husband had to join them in holding her back.
"You horrible witch!"
Cinderella screamed, struggling against her brothers-in-law.
"Magic or no magic, I'll pull you apart limb from limb if you hurt my daughter."
Esmia just laughed at her.
"What have you done with our daughter, you monster?"
Chance yelled. Emeralda and Skyline placed their hands on his shoulders to keep him from charging toward her.
"She's alive.
For now," Esmia said, and casually examined her nails. "I hope there are no hard feelings. I'll give her back to you once I'm done with her. Maybe."
"What do you want with Princess Hope, Esmia?"
the fairy godmother demanded. Esmia squinted at the fairy godmother and walked in a circle around her, closely examining her former teacher.
"Why, if it isn't the big FG herself," she said. "You're looking rather old, Grams. Is something on your mind? Is something troubling you?"
"Don't be cheeky, Esmia. It's a shade you never wore well," the fairy godmother said. Esmia frowned at her playfully.
"You're good at putting on this noble facade, but I know better," she said. "Have you told them what I took from you yet?" Or have you left that part of your story out, because you were afraid they would worry more knowing you're just as terrified as the rest of them?
The fairy godmother kept her silence, not giving in to Esmia's games.
Fine, I'll tell them, Esmia said, and faced the rest of the room. I have her granddaughter.
Everyone in the room gasped, including the twins. What was she talking about? Alex wondered. The fairy godmother looked puzzled as well, wondering if the enchantress had managed to get a hold of Alex as well as Charlotte.
My granddaughter? The fairy godmother asked.
Esme rolled her eyes.
Oh, don't look surprised, she said. I took her weeks ago. You had to have known. I left you plenty of clues.
The fairy godmother looked at Esme with the most neutral face she could muster.
How did you get to her?
She asked.
It was simple, as most things are for me, Esme
said, with a small shrug.
I stole that book of yours, the old one, with all our history in it, the portal. I cast a tiny spell on it and was able to pluck straight out of the other world. I said, bring me the Bailey girl from the place where the fairy godmother's precious Bailey family resides, and that was all. Stupid woman. She didn't even pretend to be someone else. She told me exactly who she was right from the beginning.
Alex grabbed Connor's hand, and they locked eyes.
She thinks Mom is me,
Alex whispered to her brother.
And Mom must be going along with it,
Connor whispered back.
But why was she taken instead of you?
Alex clutched Connor's shoulder as the answer came to her.
Connor, I was in my honors class when Mom went missing. I was in the next town. I wasn't in the place where we reside. That's why she got Mom instead.
The fairy godmother began nodding her head, coming to the same conclusion as the twins. She looked over to Red and stared down at her huge gown again. The twins could have sworn she was looking straight at them.
Did she know they were under there?
Whatever she did or didn't know, it made the fairy godmother stand a little taller, knowing the enchantress had made a grave mistake.
I'll admit you have our attention now, the fairy godmother said, quickly looking back to Esmia. So what is it that you want from us? Why have you graced us with your presence tonight?
A menacing smile grew on the enchantress's face. This was the part she'd been waiting 2 centuries to tell.
As you may have guessed, I've decided to take over the world,
Esmia said, matter-of-factly with a small yawn.
But rather than continuing to show you examples of my powerful wrath, I've decided to give you an opportunity that will make all our lives easier. I want you all to renounce your thrones and hand over your kingdoms to me, willingly.
The entire room erupted in outrage. The men had to restrain Cinderella once again.
Never,
Chance shouted, speaking for everyone in the room.
Even with an entire kingdom consumed and a young princess's life at stake, there's still some hesitation,
Esmia said, shaking her head.
I'm going to take over. It's unpreventable. I'm giving you a chance to accept your defeat with dignity. You'd be wise to take it.
No one moved or made a sound under Esmia's heavy glare. She turned to Sleeping Beauty, who was still on the floor, trembling under the enchantress's gaze.
Why don't you do it first, Sleeping Beauty?
Esmia said.
Show your fellow rulers how easy it is. Your kingdom has been through enough already, wouldn't you agree? Ease their sufferings. Do it for your people. For your husband. If you hand me over your kingdom, I'll release it from my enchanted plants. Do we have a deal?
All was quiet while Sleeping Beauty contemplated the impossible decision. Snow White and Rapunzel shook their heads, urging her not to give in. Finally, Sleeping Beauty stood up and slowly walked over to stand behind the fairy godmother.
Any partnership I make will be made against you, Sleeping Beauty said, and my people would expect nothing less.
All the monarchs and fairies looked to one another, inspired by Sleeping Beauty's bravery. One by one, they walked across the ballroom and stood behind the fairy godmother, showing the enchantress where their loyalties would remain. Esmia was beside herself with rage. The twins were positive they could see small flames flickering from her eyes.
You're all making the greatest mistake of your reigns, she said, but don't worry. They'll be ending soon.
The fairy godmother took a few confident steps toward Esmia.
No one in this room may be able to stop you, Esmia,
the fairy godmother said, and then glanced in the twins' direction.
But I have nothing but the highest confidence someone unrevealed will find a way.
Alex and Connor looked to each other. Her words were so carefully chosen.
Was she talking about them?
Esme's anger turned to amusement, and she let out a long laugh.
I see, she said. You think you're all safe standing behind your precious fairy godmother.
Well, in case you think her promising words alone can save you, allow me to clarify.
Esmir reached an open hand toward the fairy godmother, and a gigantic bolt of lightning erupted from it. It hit the fairy godmother, and she disappeared. A turquoise jar appeared in the enchantress's hand, and a ghostly version of the fairy godmother appeared inside of it.
"What will the rest of you do now that I have the fairy godmother's soul?" Esmir asked the room.
Alex and Connor squirmed frantically around in Red's gown. Alex had to hold her brother back as he tried running toward the enchantress like Cinderella.
"She's got Grandma!"
Connor whispered, begging his sister to let him go.
"She's got Grandma!"
"She can't know we're here, Connor,"
Alex whispered back to him.
"Consider this my final warning," Esmir declared to the crowd. "My attacks on your kingdoms will continue until you surrender to me. We'll see where you stand when all your people are begging you to make the suffering end. Your days of happily ever after are over."
Another gigantic bolt of lightning hit the palace, and the enchantress disappeared, taking the fairy godmother with her. Everyone in the room was as pale as Snow White. The twins froze inside Red's gown, with their hearts broken. No one knew what to do. All the kings, queens, and fairies searched for some sign of optimism in one another's eyes, but there was none to be found. For the first time in history, the leaders of the fairy tale world were helpless. Chapter 13. Jars of Souls. Deep in the heart of the dwarf forest, where the trees and shrubbery grew the thickest, was a small hut unseen by all who passed it. A witch named Agatha had lived in the hut many years ago and strategically planted a wall of thorn bushes around her home, making it virtually impossible to find. And although the witch was long dead, the hut had more residents now than ever before. The enchantress had turned the hut into her new home following the restoration of her powers. It still looked the same on the outside, with only two windows and a hay roof, but it had been charmed to become a spacious manor the moment someone walked through the door. It had large rooms with high ceilings and black stone walls. A wide fireplace was made of amethyst stones, within which a fire of purple flames burned a collection of skulls like firewood. The furniture was made of exotic porcupine and salamander animal skins. A chandelier made of various species' teeth hung from the ceiling, but gave no light. It was usually a quiet place, but tonight the piercing cries of a child echoed through its halls.
"Please be quiet, little princess," said Rumpelstiltskin.
Princess Hope was more than half his size, but he still rocked the one-year-old back and forth, trying to soothe her.
"Mama,"
the princess cried.
"Mama!"
"You can't have your mama, I'm afraid,"
Rumpelstiltskin told the child, and she bawled harder than ever before.
"She's been crying for more than a day," said Charlotte Bailey from the back of the room. "Would you please just give her to me?"
The twins' mother was imprisoned in a large birdcage that swung a few feet above the ground.
"What makes you think you can get her to stop crying?"
Rumpelstiltskin said. He was exhausted from having to care for the child the last day.
"I'm a nurse. It's what I do," she said.
Charlotte was still dressed in her nursing scrubs. She had just finished a shift at the children's hospital when a mysterious blanket of light wrapped around her and transported her into the fairy tale world. It didn't take long for Charlotte to realize that the enchantress who had summoned her there was after her daughter, and so for Alex's protection, Charlotte had pretended to be her daughter. It didn't appear that Princess Hope would calm down anytime soon. Against his better judgment, Rumpelstiltskin handed the young princess to Charlotte through the bars of the cage. He didn't care how angry Esmir would be to find the child with the other prisoner. He just wanted the crying to stop. Rumpelstiltskin had never been good with kids.
"There, there, baby girl,"
Charlotte said, and stroked Hope's auburn curls.
"It's all going to be okay. It's all going to be okay."
Slowly but surely, Princess Hope calmed down in Charlotte's maternal embrace, sleeping for the first time since she had been taken. All the young princess needed was a mother's touch. Rumpelstiltskin was so relieved to have silence. He could have slept for 3 days if he were allowed. Charlotte studied the little man. Nothing about him was malicious like his master. He seemed like such a gentle and kind man.
"So you're Rumpelstiltskin?" she asked him.
"Yes,"
he said with a remorseful shrug, ashamed of the reputation that came with his name.
"Did you really spin hay into gold for the maiden, like the story says?"
Charlotte asked.
"That I did,"
Rumpelstiltskin admitted.
"And did you really try to take her firstborn child away from her?"
Charlotte said, finding it hard to believe. Rumpelstiltskin let out a heavy sigh. That's what Esmia wanted me to do, he said, but I couldn't go through with it. I told the maiden, well, she was a queen by that point, that I would dismiss her into our bargain if she could guess my name. And she did, if I recall, Charlotte said. It had been a while since she'd heard the story. I made sure she did, Rumpelstiltskin confessed. I caught one of her soldiers following me. I danced around a fire, proclaiming my name to the whole forest as loud as I could. So you intentionally made it easy for her? She said. That was very kind of you. A tiny smile grew on Rumpelstiltskin's face, but it quickly faded. I thought so too, he said. Unfortunately, no one will ever know that part of the story. People are quick to judge, Charlotte said, and I'm no exception. I never wondered why you did all those things. My mind was just made up that you were a villain? Rumpelstiltskin asked, unfazed. It was what he had been known as the majority of his life. Yes, a villain, Charlotte admitted. Rumpelstiltskin was growing very comfortable talking to Charlotte. Too comfortable. Had he not been so tired, he might have kept his guard up, but he couldn't deny that there was something trustworthy about Charlotte. They were both good people stuck in a bad situation. How did someone like you get mixed up with someone like her? Charlotte asked, shaking her head. Because I had the misfortune of being born a dreamer, he said sadly. A dwarf is born with one option, become a miner. A life spent in dark tunnels under the ground was never what I wanted for myself. I always loved being outside with the plants and animals. I used to daydream about being a shepherd or a farmer. My brothers used to scold me day and night for it. They said being a miner was an honor and that I was lucky. Then one day, Esme came to me with an offer to be her apprentice. Rumpelstiltskin rubbed his eyes and took a seat on a porcupine skin chair, too fatigued to mind the needles poking him. It's funny, he said. I didn't think twice about saying yes, but I've regretted it every day of my life. Charlotte couldn't help but feel sorry for him. She realized there were three prisoners under this roof. Anyone would have said yes if they were in your shoes, she said. Back then, perhaps, Rumpelstiltskin agreed, but now no one would ever admit to it. A strong breeze blew through the room. Why is the child with her? Said a booming voice that made Charlotte and Rumpelstiltskin jump. Esmia had suddenly appeared. The enchantress seemed tired. Her posture wasn't quite as straight, and her hair didn't flow as freely as it had before. Esmia had been planning this night for a long time, and it hadn't ended the way she wanted. Rumpelstiltskin immediately hopped out of the chair. Princess Hope wouldn't stop crying, he said, and I wanted you to have a silent home to return to. Esmia scowled at Charlotte, and she held onto the princess even tighter. The enchantress moved toward the cage and peered in at them through the bars like a praying hawk. You're awfully good with children, aren't you? Esmia said suspiciously. I told you, I'm a nurse, it's my job, Charlotte said, shifting uncomfortably under the enchantress's gaze. I take care of sick children at a hospital. Esmia raised an eyebrow. Interesting, she said. I never expected the fairy godmother's granddaughter to be so old. Well, not all of us have magic holding us up, Charlotte retorted. You've got spirit, I'll give you that, Esmia said. Perhaps this will humble you. Esmia placed the glass jar she had been carrying on a small table close to Charlotte's cage. Charlotte was horrified to see a miniature, ghostly version of the fairy godmother trapped inside. That's my grandmother, Charlotte said, almost forgetting she was still pretending to be her own daughter. What have you done to her? A smile appeared on Esmia's face, matching the satisfaction in her eyes. I captured her soul, she said. The thought almost made Charlotte sick. She had no idea such a thing was possible, even in the fairy tale world. What do you want with her soul? Charlotte asked. It's a bit of a hobby of mine, actually, Esmia said, and walked to her fireplace. Displayed proudly on the mantle were five other turquoise jars, each containing a ghostly substance. You're a soul collector? Charlotte asked. Is it to make up for being soulless? What a clever play on words, Esmia said mockingly. You know that phrase, forgive and forget? Well, I always disagreed with it. I found it impossible, actually. People would do me wrong and then forget about me, as if their actions didn't matter, because I didn't matter. How was I supposed to forgive people like that? So you imprisoned their souls instead of forgiving? Charlotte said. Precisely, Esmia said. I found taking away the life force to be much more appealing than simply forgiving. To forgive would be to allow them to continue living their lives, free of consequence. But by taking their souls and preventing them from all future happiness, I could heal and find peace.
Charlotte couldn't believe what she was hearing.
Do you honestly expect anyone to sympathize with that?
Charlotte asked her. Esmea stared into the fire at the burning skulls, almost in a trance.
I don't want the world to understand. I want it to grovel, she said.
The confession made Charlotte's heart heavier. She wondered if she would ever escape the clutches of a person who thought like this. But thinking about her children, Bob, and the life she had been stolen from, gave Charlotte the strength to survive the Enchantress's imprisonment.
I find it hard to believe that the fairy godmother, who is known for her generosity, would harm you in any way, Charlotte said.
Sometimes help can be just as destructive as harm, Esmea said, but I imagine someone who helps for a profession couldn't comprehend that.
Enlighten me, Charlotte challenged. The Enchantress raised her eyebrows.
The fairy godmother found me in the other world when I was just a girl, Esmea said. I was alone, orphaned, and starving. She brought me here to live with the fairies in the fairy kingdom. They gave me a home, taught me how to use magic in a productive manner, and in time trained me to become one of the greatest fairies in the kingdom.
Charlotte shook her head as though she had misunderstood. That doesn't sound like something to begrudge, she said.
Success can scar you as much as failure, Esmea continued.
The more I surpassed the other fairies with my talents, the more they resented me. Fairies are incredibly jealous creatures, although no one ever talks about it, because it would tamper with their image. When the fairy godmother declared me her protege, all the other fairies distanced themselves from me. I had never asked for the attention, but they targeted their frustrations on me as if I had done something to personally offend them. Every spell I cast and every enchantment I performed was subject to an unjustified amount of criticism. Even though I was accomplishing incredible things left and right, my achievements were ignored because of the special treatment I received. I became ashamed of my gifts, and mediocrity became my new goal, wanting to be in the same league as the others. Lowering my standards only aggravated them more, and by the time I reached adolescence, I was alone and starving again, but this time for affection.
The Enchantress gestured to the jars displayed on her mantle.
Which brings us to these, she said. Now this section of the story is very close to my heart, you see, because inside the jars on my mantle are the souls of 5 men who unwisely broke it. One man who never loved me. One man who couldn't love me. One man who loved me too much. One man who loved me in secret. And one man who didn't love me enough.
Esmea picked up the jar farthest to the left and looked inside it. A figure of a young man wearing an apron appeared in the ghostly substance inside.
The baker was my first love, the Enchantress said. He lived in a small village in the Charming Kingdom and worked in his family's bakery. He was the first person besides the fairy godmother to ever ask me if I was having a good day. I was so young and vulnerable. All it took was a shared smile to make me fall madly in love with him. We became very close, and I confessed my deepest secrets and desires to him. I was positive our love would last forever. Unfortunately for me, I learned his intentions were anything but genuine. I had been the subject of a practical joke. The baker had pretended to have feelings for me, only to report back to the other village youths everything I had confessed to him. He had been playing a game with my heart the whole time. I went back to the fairy kingdom in tears. I was hoping for some kind of sympathy from them, some sort of compassion, but instead, they just laughed at me. They were happy to see something topple me from the pedestal I had never been asked to be placed on. You see, I had broken an unwritten rule. Apparently, a person of privilege is never allowed to complain about anything. With no one to confide in and no shoulder to cry on, I ran into the forest and collapsed onto the roots of a tree. I lay there for hours and cried my heart out into its bark. That tree was the only thing that ever comforted me from the pain. And I visited that tree quite a bit over the years. Over time, I tried forgiving the baker, but it only angered me more. I returned to his bakery and demanded an apology. He refused, saying the whole thing had been a childish prank. So, I cast a spell on a gingerbread man he was baking. It jumped up from the tray and ran away from him.
It became quite the ordeal. The entire village chased after it with no success. The baker and his family became the laughingstock of the village, and they lost their bakery. But it made me feel so much better. That's when I learned that taking the high road would never give me the satisfaction as getting even. The enchantress set aside the baker's jar and moved on to the one next to it. A man holding a hammer with a chain draped over his shoulder appeared in the jar. The locksmith was a troubled man, Esmia said, and shook her head. A testament to his profession, he liked keeping his properties locked down, and I was no exception. I fell for him mostly out of convenience, needing something to repair my heart from the damage left by the baker. He was such a quiet man. He barely said a word to me. He never looked me in the eye, and when he touched me, it was rarely out of affection. He definitely left his mark on me. Several, actually. And like a fool, I stayed, thinking it might be the only type of love I would ever receive. When I finally told him I was leaving him, he didn't even blink. He had so many demons already, I didn't feel the need to cause him more distress when we parted. I felt more anger toward myself than I did toward him, for letting him harm me. I kept him as a reminder, to never let myself sink to such pitiful depths again. Charlotte and Rumpelstiltskin looked sideways at each other. They couldn't believe the enchantress was telling them so much. But Esmia had completely lost herself in a stroll through the most painful memories of her past. The trip down memory lane wasn't entirely for them, however. Telling her captives the stories of her former loves appeared to gradually rejuvenate her from her long night. She stood taller, and her hair flowed more vigorously above her. The purple flames in Esmia's fireplace even grew the more she reminisced. It was undeniable. The enchantress was fueled by the pain of her past. Esmia picked up the third jar in the center of the mantle. A man playing a pipe appeared in the cloudy substance. "The musician was the lover I thought I had been waiting for," Esmia confessed. "I was so taken by his charm. He constantly serenaded me with songs and sonnets. He was so eager to confess our love to the world. Too eager. I soon realized that it wasn't me he was in love with. It was the idea of me. He wanted the world to know he was connected to the future fairy godmother, not Esmia. He was using me like a ladder. However, I stayed with him despite knowing his true intentions, dreading the thought of being alone. I showered him with gifts, in particular, an infamous pipe he used to magically clear town of rats. I had enchanted the pipe myself and had hoped it would equalize our statuses. I thought if I gave him something that made him feel as important as me, he would learn to love me for me and not my title. Sadly, the only thing that grew following his victory was his ego, and it led him to infidelity as easily as he had led the rats to the river. I transformed his new lover into an instrument, so he could forever play her in the same way he had played with me. The enchantress picked up the fourth jar on the mantle. She stared inside at the soul of a man dressed from head to toe in armor. "The soldier was a very guarded man," Esmia said. "He kept our relationship a total secret. It was refreshing to be with someone so private after the musician. Later, I discovered his discretion was not to protect me, but to protect himself. The soldier was ashamed of our relationship. He thought if word broke that he was courting a fairy, it would damage his career, and he would never be promoted to a general. I cast a spell on him that flattened his feet and stiffened his joints. He spent the rest of his days guarding the entrance to a kitchen and never received any promotion at all." The enchantress moved on to the final jar on the mantle. A handsome young man wearing robes and a crown appeared inside of it. Esmia looked at him differently than she had all the others. It was clearly the hardest memory to relive. "The king hurt me more than anyone," the enchantress confessed. "Unlike all the others, the king treated me with the compassion all the rest failed to. He was my best friend and the only person who I felt loved me back. Perhaps that common kinship is what made me fall for him more than the others, and is why it still hurts to this day. However, he never loved me as much as I loved him. Friendship was the only thing he wanted from me. I visited him every day, hoping he would change his mind. One day he caught me trying to give him a love potion. I had never seen him so angry. He shouted for the entire castle to hear that he would never love me the same way I loved him, even with all the love potions in the world. I lost my temper, and I cursed the king to live as a hideous beast, turning him into the monster I thought he was. Eventually, he found a girl to love him despite his animalistic features, and my curse was broken. The story of Beauty and the Beast has been exaggerated over time. but the king never told a soul I was the one who cursed him. He was still a friend after everything I had done to him. The king's rejection was the final break my heart could take. I thought if the king was incapable of loving me, then no one could. The fairy godmother says I changed over that period of time, and she's right. I represented happily ever after, but couldn't find a happily ever after for myself. Everywhere I went, I was expected to solve problems, but I couldn't salvage my own. I began hating the world I stood for. I hated the fairies. I hated the pathetic people they helped, and I hated myself for being one of them. I stopped pretending I belonged among them. For the first time, I began to say and do what I wanted, rather than what I was expected to. If the other fairies were going to condemn me regardless of what I did, I figured I might as well give them valid reasons to. When they replaced me on the Happily Ever After assembly and gave my seat to Emeralda, I can't say I was surprised. I was furious and hurt, but I knew the fairies had secretly been waiting for an excuse to take something away from me. Emeralda had never been as gifted as me, but she had always been so loved by everyone she met. The fairies knew appointing her would hurt me the most. I ran into the forest and found my trustworthy tree to cry into. I stayed and cried for days and days. I felt as if my soul had finally been crushed, as if my entire life had been a cruel experiment to see how much heartbreak I could withstand. When I finally dried my tears, I looked up at the tree. It was significantly taller than all the other trees in the forest. After all the tears I had shed over the years into its roots, the tree had surpassed all the others surrounding it. I was so ashamed of myself. I couldn't believe what I had let the world do to me. I cast a spell on the tree, causing it to curve and loop like a vine, until it was the same height as all the other trees, and the evidence of my heartbreak was gone. That's the moment that the fragile, heartbroken fairy inside of me died, and the enchantress was born. I decided from then on, if the world was going to speak of my name, it would be whispered in fear rather than mocked with envy. If the world was going to take all the joy from me, I would simply take away all the joy from the world. Esme had almost forgotten she wasn't alone. All the pain from her past was what had created the person she was today, so it was difficult for her to realign herself with the present. "Everyone goes through heartache," Charlotte said. "I've been through my own share of loss, but I got over it. I never plotted a ruthless revenge scheme or held the world responsible for it." Esme had jerked her head toward her. "Really?" she said angrily. "Have you ever felt loneliness so strong that it hollowed your soul with every heartbeat? Have you ever hated the sun for rising and forcing another day of solitude upon you?" "I suppose not," Charlotte said. "No one ever had trouble loving me." Rumpelstiltskin gasped at Charlotte's bold statement. Esme was almost impressed by Charlotte's fearlessness. "Careful," Esme warned her. "There's a thin line between bravery and stupidity." Charlotte turned away, unable to look at her anymore. Esme placed the jar containing the king's soul back on the mantle. "I should retire for the night," she said. "I know I make it look so effortless, but world domination is exhausting. I'm going to rest for a bit before continuing my attacks across the kingdoms. I want to be at my best when I cause the world's worst." Esme headed toward her chambers for the night, but Rumpelstiltskin stopped her before she left the room. "Esme," Rumpelstiltskin asked, carefully filtering any judgment in his tone. "Are you sure you'll ever find peace? Even after taking over the world, are you certain you'll be satisfied?" Charlotte turned back, interested to hear the answer. A malevolent smile appeared on the Enchantress's face. "Silly Rumpy," Esme said with a laugh. "Who said I only wanted this world?" Chapter 14. The Wand of Wonderment. The carriage ride back into the Red Riding Hood Kingdom was a difficult trip to make. Witnessing the Enchantress take their grandmother's soul was the most devastating thing the twins had ever seen. Alex cried into her brother's shoulder for most of the trip back to Red's Castle.
"She has Mom! She has Grandma! And soon she'll have the whole fairy tale world!" Alex sobbed. "She's taken everything from us!"
"Not everything, Alex," Connor said. His was the only reassuring voice in the carriage. "We have each other, and we'll figure out a way to get them back." Although they appreciated his optimism, Froggy and Red couldn't help but have doubts. The world had been counting on the fairy godmother for a solution, and now that she was gone, nothing seemed powerful enough to stand against the Enchantress.
"I'm not sure we can fight this one, Connor," Alex said, with tears spilling out of her eyes like a leaky faucet. For the first time, I think the bad guy may win this story.
The despair grew inside the carriage with every mile it traveled. The twins, Froggy, and Red racked their brains for a solution, but couldn't come up with anything. After a day and a half of traveling and worrying, they were very eager to reach Red's castle.
That's funny, Red said, looking out the window. I would have expected to be past the wall by now.
Froggy and the twins looked out the window, too. They were surprised there was no sign of the wall in the distance. It did seem to be taking longer than usual to get back to the Red Riding Hood Kingdom.
Wait a minute, Connor said, and squinted at something in the distance. Does that say what I think it says?
The others looked out the window to what he was referring to. The carriage slowly passed a sign that made their stomachs turn. Bo Peep Family Farms.
How is that possible? Red said, and her eyes grew twice in size. The Bo Peep Farms are inside my kingdom. Where was the wall?
Froggy and the twins stared out at the rural hills surrounding them, wondering the same thing. A few moments later, they discovered a group of Red Riding Hood soldiers standing at the side of the road. They scratched their heads and looked around in bewilderment, just as confused as they were. Froggy opened the door and poked his head out of the carriage as they passed them.
Excuse me, good sirs. What is going on? Where is the wall?
There is no wall, sir, one of the soldiers said in disbelief.
What do you mean there is no wall? Froggy asked.
I mean, there is no wall anymore, sir, the soldier said. The whole thing disappeared earlier this morning.
What? Red gasped.
We were guarding the southern entrance when a bright flash came out of nowhere, another soldier explained. The next thing we knew, the whole wall was gone.
Alex and Connor turned to each other, each thinking the same thing.
The Enchantress, Alex said. She started her attacks.
Red placed a hand over her chest, trying to calm her uncontrollably beating heart. Even after hearing the Enchantress's warning firsthand, she never thought her home would be targeted.
Were there any casualties? Froggy asked the soldiers.
No, sir, one replied. Just a lot of confusion.
Froggy shut the carriage door and sank into a seat across from the twins.
So it begins, he said sadly to himself.
It was dusk by the time the carriages approached Red's castle. They felt so exposed without the wall, and as they looked around the town, it was apparent the villagers felt the same. Everywhere they looked, wooden boards were nailed over doors and windows of the homes and shops, as if the residents were preparing for a storm.
I haven't seen people this frightened since the Big Bad Wolf was around, Red said. It reminds me of the days before the Crawl Revolution.
Froggy took Red's hand in his. Her mind was too preoccupied to notice its cold, slimy texture.
Esmea could have done much worse, Froggy said. Thankfully, it was just the wall.
His words had the opposite effect of what he'd intended. Red pulled her hand out from his, and her eyes became watery.
It's not just a wall, Red yelled. That wall is what separates us from the rest of the world. It represents our safety and victory after years of struggling. The Big Bad Wolf and his succeeding pack may be gone, but that wall has always been a symbol of peace to my people.
Red wiped away the few tears that escaped, embarrassed by her outburst.
As soon as we get back to my castle, I'm going to order a line of soldiers to surround the town at once, Red said, and nodded to herself. We may not have a wall, but we will be protected.
Froggy and the twins nodded along with her. The twins liked seeing Red give an official and selfless order as queen. Maybe Froggy had been right about her. Maybe there was much more to Red than they had ever considered. They eventually reached the castle, and as soon as Red gave her orders to the soldiers, the four of them headed into the library for a much-needed quiet and recuperative evening. But as they walked in, they were shocked to discover a surprise visitor who had been waiting their arrival.
Jack!
Red yelled. The infamous Jack of Beanstalk fame was nonchalantly sitting in one of the armchairs. He was tall and handsome, with broad shoulders, exactly how the twins remembered him. He wore suspenders, and his trusty axe hung from his belt.
Hello, Red, Jack said, and stood to greet the group.
Red went pale and stiff as a statue.
What are you doing here?
She managed.
Visiting, obviously, Jack said with a smile.
The young queen could only make a couple high-pitched squeals as she attempted to form another question. Froggy's eyes went back and forth between Red and Jack. He couldn't decide if the surprise was good or bad.
Well, this is unexpected, Froggy said, and chose to smile.
Jack's face lit up when he saw the twins.
I remember you two, he said.
Hi, Jack, Alex said.
Hey, man, Connor said. Despite everything else on their minds, the twins were glad to see him. Red grew anxious quickly, and she began looking around the library.
Wait, Jack, if you're here, then that means... Slam!
The library doors shut with gusto. They all turned to see Goldilocks standing behind them.
You!
Red said, and pointed to her. She quickly backed away from her old nemesis.
Hello, Red, Goldilocks said with a fake smile.
She wore tall leather boots and a long maroon knitted sweater. A silver sword swung from her side. She had golden curls and was just as beautiful as the last time the twins saw her. There was something different about Goldilocks and Jack that the twins noticed. They both looked much happier now that they were on the run together.
Goldilocks,
Alex said, and she and her brother ran to give Goldilocks a hug.
What a wonderful surprise,
Goldilocks said, and a proud smirk appeared in her face.
I would say it's nice to see you again, children, but you're hardly children anymore.
Connor nodded. Thank you, he said. That's what we've been trying to tell everyone. Goldilocks playfully rubbed his head.
I had at least 4 warrants for my arrest by the time I was your age, she said, and then winked at Jack.
Jack smiled at her.
I'm a late-blooming bandit myself, but I'm catching up, he said, and winked back.
They lovingly stared at each other as if no one else was in the room.
You!
Red said, still pointing at Goldilocks. She looked like a teapot whose spout had been corked.
Oh, relax, Red, Goldilocks said. We aren't here to cause any trouble. I'm not going to hurt you.
Red snorted.
You bet your porridge-loving, indecisive behind you won't be harming me. This is my castle, she said. You're both wanted fugitives. How did you get inside?
We used the front door, Jack said blankly. They let us in without any trouble. I grew up with most of the gods, remember?
Red looked back and forth between Jack and Goldilocks, not wanting to believe the statement was true. It was frustrating to feel so disrespected in her own home.
Does the word queen mean anything to anyone? Red shouted. Shouldn't my safety be a priority in my castle?
Froggy decided to break the tension.
Forgive us. We weren't expecting company, and we've had a rough few days, he explained, still a little on edge himself.
Why don't we have a seat and catch up?
No one argued. Everyone took a seat around the big bad wolf floor rug. It took a minute for Red to gather her thoughts and join them. She sat next to Froggy, but left a noticeable space between them. Jack and Goldilocks sat across from them. Sitting so close to each other, they looked joined at the hip. Alex and Connor shared an armchair adjacent to the couple's.
You just returned from the Happily Ever After assembly meeting, I take it, Goldilocks asked.
Indeed, Red said, with her nose raised slightly. Because that's what we law-abiding rulers do. We meet publicly and discuss things that benefit the greater good.
Her words didn't affect Goldilocks in the slightest.
Where's the fun in that?
Goldilocks said, happy to get under Red's skin.
How did it go? Jack asked.
It was awful, Connor said.
The Enchantress showed up and kidnapped our grandmother, and she already has our mom. Jack and Goldilocks looked to each other with the same inquisitive expression.
What could she want with your mother and grandmother?
Goldilocks asked the twins. Alex and Connor had forgotten Jack and Goldilocks had made a run for it long before they discovered who their grandmother was.
Our grandmother is the fairy godmother,
Alex said with a shrug that said, surprise. Jack and Goldilocks looked rather impressed.
Well, how about that? Jack said.
The twins told them all about how they were from another world, and their grandmother had traveled back and forth for centuries, sharing the stories of the fairy tale world with theirs. Once Jack and Goldilocks had processed the information, the twins continued to tell them how their father had used the wishing spell to be reunited with their mother in the other world, and how they discovered the fairy tale world by traveling through their grandmother's old storybook.
Yes, 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 and it was all very touching, Red said, waving her hands. They learned the fairy godmother was their grandmother, and then all three of them disappeared through a door that led into a different world. Blah, blah, blah. You still haven't told me what you two are doing in my castle.
The twins could tell Jack and Goldilocks were interested in hearing more of the story, but knew they'd better appease Red before her head exploded.
We wanted to see if any progress had been made with the Enchantress, Jack said.
Nope, there hasn't been any. Sorry, you both can leave now,
Red replied quickly. Froggy placed his hand on her knee.
Darling, let's not be rude, Froggy said. They may be emotionally distressing wanted fugitives, but they're still our guests.
The twins were eager to tell Jack and Goldilocks about the meeting from the previous night and didn't wait for Froggy or Red to get to it. They told them all about Princess Hope being kidnapped and how the Enchantress had taken their grandmother and was starting to attack the kingdoms.
And there's nothing that can be done to stop her? J Jack said, shaking his head in the same disbelief the twins had felt for days.
Unfortunately not, Froggy said.
I don't know how the situation concerns the two of you, Red said, and crossed her arms.
This affects us too, Goldilocks said. We don't want to live in a world ruled by her either. We thought we could help.
Help? Red said, and laughed at the idea. And what are you going to do, Goldilocks? Steal her jewels, pick her locks, test all her furniture until it's just right?
Goldilocks stood and glared down at Red. It made the queen squirm in her seat. She looked to the others for help, but she was on her own.
Is there something you want to say to my face, Grandma's girl? Goldilocks asked. No, I'd much rather say it behind your back, Red said.
I thought after helping me escape you had changed, Goldilocks said, but apparently I was wrong.
Well, I thought helping you would make me feel better, but I suppose I was wrong too, Red admitted, and sheepishly glanced over at Jack.
Froggy raised his green index finger.
Moving back to more important matters, he said, the fairies and monarchs don't have any clue what to do. The fairy godmother has always been able to just wave her wand and make things better, but unfortunately she can't this time. So now we're all waiting for a solution to arise, if there is one.
The twins nodded. Goldilocks sat back down next to Jack and held his hand. The room was reunited with the hopelessness they had tried leaving in the carriage. Suddenly, Connor cocked his head like a puppy. Froggy, what did you just say? He asked, pointing at his amphibious friend.
I said no one knows what to do, Froggy said, not sure how he could have made it clearer.
No, before that, Connor said. What did you say about the fairy godmother? Froggy looked at him peculiarly, wondering why he wanted the horrible news to be repeated.
I said the fairy godmother usually just waves her wand and makes everything better, he said.
Bingo, Connor said, and immediately jumped out of the armchair and ran toward the bookshelves.
Connor, what's gotten into you? Alex asked.
Hey, Froggy, Connor asked, completely in his own world. Where is that book we were looking at the other day, the one that had the chapter about the wishing spell in it? It took a moment for Froggy to remember.
Myths, legends, and collecting spells? He asked.
It should be on the shelf two over and one below the books from your sister.
I am very specific about where my books are kept.
Connor scanned the shelves until he found it. Gotcha, he said with a satisfied jump. He sat back down next to his sister and flipped through the pages. I think the answer we're looking for is in this book.
Are you talking about using the wishing spell again? Froggy asks.
Could we use it on the Enchantress? Jack asks.
Trust me, wishing someone away never works, Red said, and raised an eyebrow in Goldilocks' direction.
Goldilocks placed a hand on her sword as a warning.
We couldn't use the wishing spell even if we wanted to, Alex said. The spell could only be used twice, and the evil queen was the second person to use it.
I'm not talking about the wishing spell, Connor said, his eyes still glued to the pages he was searching.
I'm thinking about something even bigger and better, and
found it. Connor turned the book around to the section he was referring to.
The Wand of Wonderment?
The room read together. Connor nodded enthusiastically, expecting them all to share his excitement. Unfortunately, everyone else just exchanged pitying looks with one another. Why are you all looking at me like I want to take my pet rock for a walk? Connor asked. This book says whoever holds the Wand of Wonderment is invincible. Whoever gets their hands on it could potentially stop the Enchantress.
Froggy looked at him regretfully. This isn't real, Connor, Froggy said. That's just a childish legend like all the other subjects in that book.
Okay, says the giant talking frog, Connor said with an eye roll.
This book talks about the wishing spell, too, and we've proven that that wasn't just a myth. I bet most of the stuff in this book is real, too.
The Wand of Wonderment, he read aloud from the book. Many believe that possessing the Wand of Wonderment gives the beholder the gift of invincibility. It is said that the wand is formed when combining the six most prized possessions of the six most hated people in the world. Although the idea is skeptical, the legend of the wand may have some truth to it, considering materials needed are most likely of a magic background. Unlike most collections, the materials required for making the Wand of Wonderment may change with the times.
Connor took a deep breath and looked up at the others, who still looked ambivalent. Oh, come on, Connor said to the stubborn group. You've got to admit that it doesn't seem like too much of a stretch.
Everyone was on the fence about it. Connor was frustrated they weren't as convinced as he was.
My sister and I are from another dimension, he said, and then pointed to Froggy. This guy has been magically transformed into a giant amphibian twice. What part about the Wand of Wonderment is hard for any of you to believe in?
Connor made a valid point. What about this wand was so hard for them to believe after all the other things they had witnessed? At least it was an option, and an option gave them hope.
Alex silently stared.